My name's Bill Phillips. And I grew up here. My folks came up here in 1937. And I was born in 1938, but in Seattle, as with my brother, 2 years later. And we were here till 1956 when we pulled out, when I turned 18. And what I'm going to show tonight, and this is about 60 years worth of mining history, as I have researched it with a very close friend of mine by the name of Dr. Nigel Adams. And I don't know if anybody seen his book up in the bookstore? Mm-hmm. But it's very nice. And I'm going to start primarily using his information and his slides. That book was his doctoral dissertation to earn his degree in history at the University of Washington. And so I'm going to use a lot of information from that book and some slides that he took of photos from the very earliest time frame. So what I'm going to do is start with the 1896, which was the discovery of the ore body way up on the hillside, or the mountainside. And that involved, after that, a couple of different companies that were trying to develop the property but failed to do so. In the early days of Howe Sound Company, who eventually took over the property, and the construction of all the facilities up here. And then we'll get into the homes up in Winston and a lot of the activities that particularly us kids were involved in at the time. This is a famous picture from Larry Penberthy. This is the way, of course, it looked when the mine got going. And prior to that period of time, when the mine was completed and the mill was completed, all the activity and everything was up on the side of the mountain. There was no activity, no facilities, anything in the base of the valley. The story starts, obviously, with James Henry Holden, known as Harry through his life. He was born in 1855 in Springfield, Massachusetts. The family moved to New York City, where he grew up and was educated. And when he was a young man in his 20s, as shown here, he started a business, I don't remember what that was, in New York for a couple of years, sold his business, and came out west with a few dollars. He worked in the minefields in Nevada, and then he went to Denver and was an inspector at a smelter. And then from there, he went out to San Francisco, where he met his brother, and his brother said, well, maybe you ought to go up to Seattle. There might be better opportunities up there. And as it might happen, he met the Denny family. For anybody who knows the history of Seattle, the Denny family was the founders of the city of Seattle. So he ended up with very, very good company. He became very good friends with Victor Denny, who was the son of one of these founders. And he was a gardener for him, earned money, and eventually they invited him to help in their mine. They had a very small gold mine operation on the east side of Snoqualmie Pass on Interstate 90, or where today is Interstate 90. So he learned a little bit of the mining from them, and they invited him to come over to Lake Chelan. And they had been coming to Lake Chelan apparently for several years. So he and Victor spent several summers actually in a rowboat coming up the shores of the lake, prospecting along the shores of Lake Chelan, looking for and prospecting for gold.
And oftentimes, the family, Tucker family, would come up the lake and would camp out at the Railroad Creek Bar, which is down at Lucerne, of course. And this is David Denny and his wife. They even brought their two maids from Seattle. And this is Mr. Holden. I don't know what happened to Victor. I have no idea who this person is. And they really didn't find anything. I think during the interim time, actually, Mr. Holden found ore outcroppings up on Meadow Creek opposite Lucerne and took out a claim up there. Well, come in 1896, which was our fateful year, Victor and Mr. Holden came over and prospecting again. They had bought some supplies jointly, bought a rowboat, came up the lake, didn't find anything, came back down, and David called his son back. Victor, come on back to the family mine. And gave all his supplies to Mr. Holden, and he came up here, brought in by a pack horse by a fellow by the name of Mr. Robinson. And lo and behold, he was out hunting either for grouse or deer for his lunch. He was really high up on the mountain, and he spotted this outcropping about 2,000 feet up on above the valley floor on Copper Peak. And this was ended up being a rather large find on the surface. He took many samples, sent them off to Seattle, had them analyzed, and found that he had a good claim. He then formed the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company. Up to this point, he had had some problem with Victor, who had been his previous partner. And Victor thought that after prospecting with Mr. Holden for so many years, he really deserved part of the claim. And Mr. Holden disputed that, and ended up with court going all the way to the Washington State Supreme Court. And they said, well, no, you really haven't. He paid off all his debts despite all the loans. And he didn't show any interest for a couple of years. So Holden, informing his company in 1899, basically shut off his former friend and partner. So this was a really big deal at the time, because it's kind of interesting reading the newspapers from the Chelan Leader, which was the precursor to the today's Chelan Mirror, in that today people are in Chelan, and the Chelan Valley is so doggone that the economy is so dependent upon tourism and agriculture, either in the wine industry or apple industry or food industry. And you can see the same thing was happening back then, around 1900. So this is very, very exciting, as this was part of a quote from the newspaper at that time, that they could find an industry that might be going to provide a year-round economy for the valley. And Mr. Holden thought that was pretty exciting, too. So Mr. Holden was pretty astute in trying to figure out how to get the mine worked. He knew that he really didn't have the knowledge, didn't really have the funds to be able to develop such a find up here in a very, very remote area. So he put out feelers, took samples of ore, even all the way to Denver. And finally, this particular company, Drummers Development Company, who I don't know where they came from, I've tried to do research and I can never find anything about them, decided they wanted to get involved. And they set up basically a parallel company called the Chelan Transportation and Smelting Company to develop the transportation network to get the ore out of here. and they sold stock in that particular company. And put out a prospectus which contained a number of very, very interesting illustrations. Drummers itself was going to do the development of the ore body itself with the newly formed company to take the ore out, and their idea was then to, with all the other prospecting going on in the area, to provide transportation for them and the smelter for the ore. And it's kind of an interesting concept because it looks like they were taking the ore from the upper levels of the mountain by tram down to a central place which would be accessible by a narrow gauge railway. And it doesn't look to me like they were really proposing to do any real processing, which seemed kind of short-sighted, because when you talk about ore, and particularly this one, you're talking about a very small percentage of the rock really contains the copper. In this case, this was a maximum of 2% in this particular mine. It was a very low-grade ore, in actual fact. But anyway, that's what they were proposing through this prospectus in 1901. They, in fact, did complete a road for a narrow gauge railway in 1901-1902 time frame in the valley itself, and actually set up a construction camp down the road here at 9 Mile. And the alignment of the road, as we even see today, pretty much followed this original. They proposed a series of switchbacks for a narrow gauge railway, which you go out and back over the gorge, out and back and around down in here, which is Refrigerator Harbor, which is a little bay off to the left of the Lucerne area. From there, they were talking probably a roll-on, roll-off barge type of operation, towing the down to Chelan, with another narrow gauge railway from town of Chelan down over the bluff to the shores of the Columbia River to the smelter location. One of the problems that really plagued any operation at that time is that there was no direct transportation except by riverboat on the Columbia River down the river from Chelan to Wenatchee. The main road had not been built, it was too rocky along the river. And a regular steamer on the river was really kind of risky. It wasn't until 1915 that Great Northern actually pushed a railroad from Wenatchee up the river. So this didn't really get solved at that particular time. However, they went ahead and established a work crew in Lucerne, as shown in the 1902 photo, started building a narrow gauge railway at starting at Refrigerator Harbor, most of which I think probably is underwater or even destroyed at this time with the way the water fluctuates so up and down and around through the year. For those of you who've been up to Donkey Lake, there's a ledge up there where you can look down over the lake, look up the river, look up the lake, and so forth. And this was just kind of showing the activity for their prospectus. Say, yeah, we're doing something. But they did do some work along the switchbacks on Lightning Ridge. They had a complete crew up there doing manual drilling, dynamiting, and so forth, and completed the vestiges of a railroad bed, but it was pretty doggone narrow, and as you can see in this one here, looking south toward Donkey Mountain and then north, you can see the lake down below. Nothing really came of this. They developed, I guess, about a couple thousand feet of tunnel, and that was about it, and they opted out. one thing that's kind of interesting I found, I came across this photo just this year, showing the Denny family camping again at Le Sueur in 1902. And this could be Victor, but I haven't found anybody that can identify this gentleman in this photo. This particular person right here is a well-known photographer, and there's more to say about him later on here. His name is Lawrence Denny Lindsley, and he was the grandson of David Denny. His Lindsley family had actually established a summer home in the 25 Mile Creek area, and frequently came up to the lake. If anybody's been following a lot of the photographs around this particular area, Mr. Lindsley took a lot of photographs around the Lake Chelan Valley. We find a lot of the photographs in the Chelan Museum, for example. And this is the start of one of his photographs. The next company to try to work the problem was the Granby Mining, Smelting, and Transportation Company. And they had a very remote mine up in Grand Forks, British Columbia, across the border from the panhandle of Idaho. And they extended the works that the Drummers had continued. It's a little bit tough to point out some of the features because the numbers don't show up. But this gives us the legend. He had numbered each of the features as each had photographed. But basically, the point of discovery was right about up in here. They had four tunnels, one and a half, two, about in here. I can't find the numbers 12 from this direction. This is number three, tunnel number three, a cook and bunkhouse right here. So this is the original miner's camp. Eventually, this would be the area that we know today as Honeymoon Heights. Down here was another facility for air compressors and electrical generation in 1909. And there was also two more tunnels. And I talked to Norm Day about this because this photograph that showed a number four and a number five down below what will become the 1100 level, known then as number three. Number four and number five are down in this region, and nobody's really been able to find those attics, so we don't know what happened to those. One point of interest, because I've talked two different ways of describing how these tunnels are located and how they are named. And I'll go back up here to tunnel number three, which is today's 1100 level, which is near Honeymoon Heights. You'll notice there's nothing down in here at all, which became the 1500. This is approximately 1100 feet below the original point of discovery, and that's how these footages are originally defined. Tunnel number two eventually became the 800 level, which is the biggest tailings pile that you'll see up there, that's right off to the right side of the main chute that comes off the top of the copper peak. Mr. Lindsley took photographs of just about everything he could to record the history from that particular time frame. And one of the problems that they had was being able to work these tunnels in the winter, and they normally left, went down to Chelan, and came back up, but they wanted to extend the amount of working time. And all of these tunnels at that time were completely separate. So what they started to do was make a vertical shaft from tunnel number two down to tunnel number three. And it's the excavator going downward, which in mining lingo, they call them winds. I have no idea where that word came from. There's Mr. Holden right here. And down So by having done that, that meant they could probably work this, the tunnels up there in that deep snow for a couple more months during the wintertime. In tunnel number three, an interesting feature here is notice the air hose. And they were using pneumatic drills back in 1909, and that was fairly new technology. It was very interesting that they would bring that kind of equipment up there at that particular time frame. And so they had an air compressor down below, driven by steam. The building next door then was the wood-fired boiler. And they developed a pretty good ore dump. The newspapers commented the fact that there was actually ore, not just an, native rock tailings, sitting on this rock dump at tunnel number three. And right, let's see, right here I believe is the bunkhouse and cookhouse building. I believe that's Mr. Holden's cabin. Right there. One of the things I didn't point out on the previous photo is that you notice that there's not much vegetation. You compare that to what it is today, and of course you see a burned out tree right here and a whole bunch of other snags. What happened before Mr. Holden got up here is that, as usual practice in a lot of valleys, particularly in the North Cascades, prospectors would come into an area wanting to see if there was any outcroppings would set the place on fire. And that's exactly what they did here. And looking at Mr. Lindsley's photos, the fire may have gone all the way up to Hart Lake. And I was looking on one of the trails yesterday, and some of the old Douglas firs just right around the village here still have a lot of black on them. Now, I can't prove whether that was a result of the fire back here, but my guess is, knowing that there were no fires, particularly during the time that my family's living here and Howe Sound was mining, that it could very well have come back from there. So eventually, what you see today is that it all grew back up from this particular time frame. You had a crew of I counted these out. I think it's about 15 people in here. This is Mr. Holden. That's his older son, Callie, who accompanied him up here many times, and probably their dog. This gentleman here was the supervisor for the Granby Company. And his brother back here was the local boss. And anybody here from Chelan or who's familiar with Kelly's Ace Hardware?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's Grover Kelly right there. He's the grandfather of Pat Kelly, who runs a hardware store down there. And these three gentlemen, right, I think these three here were three Italians, the Filetto brothers. They didn't know any English. And the story goes that Grover taught Aldo, I don't know which one of these, English, because all they knew was Italian. But it was a fairly small work group they were talking about. And in the background here, of course, is the cookhouse and bunkhouse. And reminding you once again, this was basically the only facility in that was in operation or being used. There was nothing down in the bottom of the valley at this point. This gives a sense of the tunnel works, and if you can imagine that you're on top of Copper Peak looking due north and looking down, this would be a planned view of all the tunnel works that they had. And so here's tunnel number three and number two, one and one and a half, and these were outer cuts where the ore body is exposed on the surface. Mm-hmm. Well, the Granby didn't make much more headway either, other than the fact they extended the length of the tunnels, found indeed that there was a very sizable ore body that would be someday worthwhile to mine out. And they had two leases, which is how Mr. Holden made his money. They never sold any ore. None was ever taken out. The only way Mr. Holden made any money was off the leases. And these two companies had options to buy. Well, they couldn't really figure out the transportation problem, so they basically gave up. Mr. Holden eventually ran out of money, and he took out a personal loan of $7,500 from a local banker, but it was a personal loan. And that was a very large sum of money at that time, of course. Well, in 1918, he died prematurely, although he looks rather old here, but he was in his late 50s, but he died of cancer. He had this very, very large debt that the estate had to pay off. Not only that, he had no will. So things were really badly compounded. His Mr. Perry went to court. The court appointed Mrs. Holden as the executrix, so she at least got some money for that. She was allowed to keep the house, but they had to sell off about a dozen lots that they had in the town of Chelan. But that was not enough to pay off the $7,500 debt. So the judge ordered that the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company be sold at auction on the steps of the county courthouse in Wenatchee. There were no bidders, so Mr. Perry says, "I'll bid." And I don't remember what he paid for it, but anyway, he ended up with the money. So he looked around for more people to take up and sell or buy the mine. There was a mine held by then Howe Sound Company up in British Columbia called Britannia Mining and Smelting Company at a place called Britannia Beach, north of Vancouver, British Columbia. And that mine, it was another copper mine, as it turns out, very similar to this operation. And it's kind of critical to the story because that's really how the final development really started here. And it's on a body of water called Howe Sound. But that mine opened up in 1905. A family by the name of Schley, S-C-H-L-E-Y, and some people recognize that name because that eventually ended up being the name on the tug that was used to haul the concentrate down the lake here. They formed a company called Howe Sound Company and bought the Britannia Mining and Smelting Company, which basically became a division as opposed to a real company. Howe Sound, even then, was headquartered back in New York. It was incorporated in the state of Maine, where the Schley family had a summer place. A fellow by the name of Brennan, who had previously worked for the Granby, knew that this mine held a lot of promising future. So, let's see if I can get to my notes here before I get lost again. So, what happened in 1928, Howe Sound Company agreed to take out an option and then later proceeded to buy the property. What's important here is that because Britannia was also in a remote area at that time, they had no road transportation and no railroad at that time. That didn't happen until the mid-60s. So their engineers, their management, and so forth came down here to start up the place. So eventually, this is what it was supposed to look like. It's what we ended up today, with the town site, tailings in Winston. And starting in 1928, the Britannia folks started making plans, built plans for the mill, and the town site. The unfortunate problem that happened is that in the year 1931, the price of copper plummeted. The operation was shut down. They pulled all their people out. The engineers and managers went back to Britannia. There was a caretaker here, and I finally came across the family members this spring. And I don't know, Mary Ellen, if you remember the Gordons?
Yes.
Pat Gordon?
Right.
And I did not know it was a family that was a caretaker. And they came up here, and they lived up here in a cabin, apparently up in this area on the valley floor. And Mr. Gordon was the caretaker for a couple of years. And they lived there in the summertime, went down to the Lucerne, lived there for the winter. One family, nobody else around, unless Manny and Getty, your father and parents
they
would have been there at that time.
Yeah, they'd been there since about 1950. My dad was there from about 1915.
Yeah,
I'm not sure just when he got the property, but he married. My mom had come up and worked summers for him for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And then they got married in 1931.
Yeah.
Bill, where did the term Winston come from for the Winston camp?
Winston came from Winston Brothers. And they did the original platting.
Oh.
They put in the facilities. They did not build any of the homes,
mm-hmm.
but they put in the electrical water systems and sewage systems. And graded out the roads, so it was named after them. They also, I think, may have been instrumental in constructing or reconstructing the road coming in. They did some of the design of the buildings down here, and they were going to build the buildings down here, but I think, from what I read from the annual reports of the company, their carpenters actually ended up working for House Island directly. And but they provided all the materials, particularly concrete and aggregate and that kind of stuff. So
they were just a construction company then, basically?
Yes, that's my understanding. So the miners' camp actually continued. It was not called Honeymoon Heights yet. You can see the long buildings in the foreground. There are a few of the private buildings, some homes for the individuals to the west. But this was called Miners Camp, not Honeymoon Heights. So the activity started again in late 1936. Things really started going, and all the heavy construction in 1937. And this gives you a pretty good shot of the long buildings. There was office buildings, bunkhouse, and cookhouse, and the private homes. Construction buildings down here, and let's see, my title here kind of obscures it, but there was also a tram that came up from the bottom of the valley all the way up to the 800 level, and that purpose of that was to then to bring the equipment up to the existing adits. You also see some white dots down here, and I've enlarged these a little bit, but I believe those are the tents that were erected in the ballpark area. One of those in 1937 was occupied by my parents. I don't know any of the other families who did that, but I know there were others. But when I asked my mother about that, she couldn't tell me who else was living down there. One of the problems was that there was no married housing, and that was part of the problem. The tents were the only thing that was available for any of the newlyweds coming up, like my folks. There was no other housing, and the bunk houses, of course, were the single men. So here's the tram and some of the construction buildings. And as near as I understand, particularly with conversations a few years back and walking up to where the Boy Scout cabin used to be, very near the ballpark, and Leilani and I were scrambling through the bushes this morning.
Hey.
And I believe, careful on this. And I believe I found the supports, which I believe were the back supports for this tram. And I can't see the bridge. There should be a bridge across at this point, too. And the tram was also used in the wintertime up to the 1800 level. This gives us kind of a general schematic of what they had to do in 1937. Build the first 10 chalets, or what we called staff houses then, the dormitories on the north side, and the dining hall, hotel. These buildings here, the number 6 and number 5, and the recreation hall or village center would be in 1938. Clearing the area for the number 1 tailings, building the mill and the shops and the main portal at the 1500 level. That's a tremendous amount of work that they had to do in the very first year, plus realigning Railroad Creek. The original bed follows this dotted line. It's not very exact, but you kind of get the idea where it went through the tailings one area. They did not disturb the mouth of Copper Creek at all. The stream bed that we see today is the result of their dredging this area. This particular area in here, part of the creek, was actually a natural overflow area when there was a heavy melt in the spring, so they just dredged that deeper. And then there was some straightening of Railroad Creek down here where to accommodate tailings 2 and tailings number 3. And of course, a lot of this has to do with what they're going to do for the upcoming mitigation efforts to pull the creek even farther away from the toe of both of these tailings areas. And here you get a little bit better detail of the original creek bed here relative to the mining claims and the relocated creek. One of the other things that was kind of a problem right from the very beginning is what do you do to get up the hill? And you know, we've all been up on the bus trip and down on the bus trip and all those switchbacks. And that construction didn't get completed until 1938. So very early, and actually it was before 1937, this tram was constructed. It was about 2,000 feet long, 1,000 foot elevation gain. The slope of it varied from about 30 degrees to almost 70 degrees. It's pretty doggone steep, with a little dock on the bottom. And this is just up lake, a couple hundred yards from the boat dock. It first started out primarily as a skidway, and you can see the heavy duty equipment, Fairbanks Morse diesel engine generators. I still have not figured out how this equipment was placed onto either this stub dock or onto this sledge or later on onto the rails. And the only thing I can figure is that, and I'll give you my idea and then some photos that are coming up, but I suspect it might have used a particular crane that was mounted on a barge, but I've never found any photos that showed that arrangement next to the shoreline. And I don't know what this guy was pulling, but I don't think I ought to be on it. But they did eventually put in ties and a three-rail system. It was actually, there was a counterweight, and midway between top and bottom, the rail split into four, so that the counterweight and the car could go by each other. But here again, you don't see any crane or anything else to lift heavy stuff onto this rail car. Up at the top, there's a level area, turnaround area. The equipment was hauled by a treaded tractor and a treaded wagon, and there were two of these outfits. And there were some trucks. I don't know for sure how they got the trucks up to here, but up the spine where the switchbacks go, you can find vestiges of trenches. And I believe that was probably the original trail, which was originally a pack horse trail. And I suspect that these tractors towed the trucks up that initial roadway before the switchbacks were built. So this gives you another view of the equipment that we just saw coming up the sledgeway with this special wagon and tractor. I suspect they probably didn't do more than about 5 miles an hour, and this is how they hauled the original heavy-duty equipment all the way up to here. Oh. Well, they eventually got a shovel, and here they're making the roadway up in, I suspect, right up in here.
How in the world did they get that thing?
Yeah, like, and look at that road. Here's three absolutely brand new shiny trucks. And that's the initial roadway trying to get in here. It wasn't even wide enough for a narrow gauge railway. I believe that this is on the road up to the 1500 level, but I've never found positive identification that way. But what a wonderful world that was to try to get in here.
What a great place to work.
Oh yeah, wouldn't it have been? Well, you see the shovel here. This is from the 1937 annual report, and a tractor making the switchbacks. And here they're finally completed with bollards, all of which have disappeared at this point. And finally, we have a road, and one of the first trucks coming up.
It's like a bus route.
Well, now back to the mill in 1937. It had to get built. And the 1500 level, the top of the mill, all the foundations that are sitting up there now, that buildings used to be on, all the way across the top, that had to be completed and was done in 1937. There was a steel shop that's out of our view sitting right in here, which is where they sharpened the drill bits for the drills. This was the warehouse on the bottom floor. This is where the general offices, general manager, engineering office, and this end. Next door was the blacksmithy, forging and welding, machine shop. And you could bring the I'll show another shot later on, but they could bring, there was a tramway inside the mill, so they could bring any equipment that needed repair up through a hole below the railroad tracks into a hole into the machine shop. Compressor building, standby electrical power generators, and the electrical substation. And that also brings up the point that the electrical power also had to be brought in, and there were three electrical lines brought in all the way from the dam below Lake Chelan, directly from the dam all the way up to here. And that was done in something like 3 or 4 months. This is a picture that was taken by Mr. Penberthy when he got up here in 1938. Tailings 1 had already been in place and was operating. When he got here, they were starting to work on tailings number 2 and 3 area. And what they had done in straightening out Railroad Creek along here was using the timbers that they cut from the trees and sunk them vertically side by side as tightly as they could along both sides of Railroad Creek. And then they also put in logs at various intervals to slow down the flow of the river and create pools and riffles and so forth for the fish. Up here there is a bridge coming across, and I think that was just a temporary bridge. At that time they left a lot of timber right along both sides of Railroad Creek. I didn't show the other picture in here, but there's actually, they started building the toe dam, which is basically was a 10-foot high earthen dam to form the base for the tailings. And then the tailings would be piled on top of that earthen dam. And there's Mr. Penberthy out here putting a choke chain around the logs to toll them out of the way. So this is clearing tailings area number 2. So in 1937, late 1937, the mill was completed. And the first ore that they actually brought in, as I understand, actually came off the 1100 level. Because up to that point, they had been working the mine. They had no mill. So they took from the workings and from the interior and the ore body out of the 800 level and then dropped down to the 1100 level and took it out and dumped it onto the waste pile on the 1100 level. They constructed a road, according to Ben Clark's biography, in about a couple of days from here up to that level, and then trucks that then hauled that initial ore down to the mill. Then, of course, we had to construct all the buildings down here, which then we called the staff houses. In the pile of snow around, which must have been difficult. These were the group of carpenters who were building the staff houses. This is number 10, that's number 9. Mm-hmm. And that's as much as they constructed by the end of 1937. Mm-hmm. And that is number 6. I think this was actually in 1938. And by that time, they're already hauling ore out. And by that time, actually by 1937, this picture was taken in 1938, but in 1937, the schoolhouse was completed. But if you look at the length of the schoolhouse, it is longer than this on the back end. For the first 2 years, 1937 and 1939, it was a one-room schoolhouse. There was a man teacher up here at that time, and all 8 grades were taught in this one forward room that exists today. In 1939, a second room had been added on the back, and Mr. Hamilton left. Mrs. Field came up that particular year, and she was the principal from 1939 until the place closed in 1957, and point out that she passed away. Excuse me. Anyway. Passed away in 105 this July 4th. And they hired a second teacher for the grades 1 through 4 in the back room. And then there was a portable sawmill, which I think was probably the one that came down from the ballpark area to provide a lot of lumber for the construction down here, as well as bringing lumber up from Schlein area. This is another photo that was taken by Mr. Penberthy showing the completion of the end of the town site in 1938. He climbed a tree and took actually two photos and then pieced them together.
I see.
But, of course, it looks all the same today, but obviously the trees have changed. You've got another tree here in the middle. But there you are. So going up to Winston with this shot in 1944, individual families built their own homes or had somebody build them for them. And as I was explaining previously, the Winston brothers came up here and constructed the roadways that you see vestiges of today, put in all of the electrical distribution to each and every lot, water, and sewage. And what we used for sewage then, because I remember very distinctly working on these cesspools, but we didn't have a septic tank system up here, but we basically had storage tanks. And every year those had to be emptied out, which is one of my first jobs. That's why I remember it. I didn't do the emptying, but I had to dig out the lids. There were concrete lids in all these tanks, and then they had to lift the lids off, and they had a pumper to empty them out.
How many homes were built there?
There were 101 homes. They were built through various years to begin with, starting in 1937, completed most of them in 1940. The first 82 or so homes in this area. Now to the west, these were arranged in various rows that I'll talk about. Out here in 1949 to 1950, another 19 homes were constructed for a total of 101. The maximum population that I came up with, and I think it was probably based on the 1950 census, was, I think it was 720-some people.
Did that include the minors?
Yes. That would have been everybody. Total count, children and everything.
Yeah.
That was the highest number I've heard of. Normally people talk about 600 to 650.
Yeah.
And this is just the fire hydrant that you see today in various places. This was the Rogers home and the Smalls, no. How many, remember how many children there was in the Rogers family?
12.
Was it 12? Is that the right number or was it 9? It was a large number. This was the largest house in the whole camp. 3 stories plus a basement.
Never really got finished, I don't think, either, did it? It seemed like it was always constructed.
Well, they were always added.
Yeah.
So this is what they look like very near completion. And this is a photo I just recently received. This, if you I'll discuss more of this tomorrow on our walking tour, but if you go up to the truck bridge and you go up the road, right, all the way up to the top, this is the house that was owned by the Kahn family. And I believe their children were raised before they came up here, but this is one of the very most top houses. But one of the things you will note in a lot of these pictures that I will be showing, that these homes were very substantially built up here. These aren't the usual mining town camp homes of tar paper and really cruddy looking. These were good 1940s homes that you would find most any place. They weren't insulated like most homes weren't, but they were very well constructed. And of course, they had to be with the amount of snow that we had on the ground. And I'll show a few more examples. And of course, at that time, the dock had to have been built. One of the first cranes that we had was what was called a stiff-legged crane mounted on a barge. And it had to swing around on the barge to service all these barges. And later on, I'll show show some more photos of what the final barge looked like. But this was not very efficient. One of the engineers figured out, well, this doesn't really work too red hot. And they eventually ended up with a locomotive type crane that ran on rails on the top of the dock. And that's what they also had done at Lucerne, done at Lyon as well. And you can see them loading. And of course, this was the shovel. It kind of empties out of water, but that's okay. But this was the shovel that came up on one of these scows. They must have had a bunch of planks to get it up here on the dock, I would presume. But this particular photo came from one of the technical magazines that was publishing what was going on up here. And one of the very early ore trucks. And we'll have more about that too. So here we are, April 1938. Everything's completed. The whole town's ready to go. All the construction currently has been completed. 42 years after discovery by Mr. Holden, the first ore out of this mine ever to be sold anyplace finally arrives down in Chelan to a cheering crowd. And it was a very, very important thing for the town of Chelan. There was a very, very severe recession, actually, in 1937. A lot of people aren't really aware of that, other than the fact, obviously, we had the stock market crash of 1929 and the Great Depression. And things kind of leveled out, and even with everything that President Roosevelt did at that time, the economy did not really fully recover. And as my friend Gene Starcher, who runs the jewelry store in downtown, who did a lot of research for one of my DVDs, said the town almost collapsed. They almost went bankrupt. And if it hadn't been for this operation, it probably would have. So it provided a lot of economy for the local Chelan Valley. So now here again, you see the completed portion at that time of Winston. You see the upper road, middle road, and lower road, and the main road, ballpark area up in here, the town site, now the village, and the tailings one, tailings two, and this area will become tailings three. And you see the mill in here, the road that comes up from the top of the mill, I mean from the bottom of the mill, excuse me, up to the 1500 level. And you see the Honeymoon Heights area, which should be right in here.
Who took that picture? Was that Henry?
I don't know who took that particular picture.
Wow.
That's a good point. So, there we are with a completed mill. Actually, this was the original garage that was handed over basically to the village. I don't know if it burned down, it got replaced. That building's no longer there, that particular one, but there's a newer one, and then there's a newer one than that. Here's the SA office here. And then you see all the various buildings at the top of the mill. And the West Rock Dump and the East Rock Dump. And these are the rock dumps, of course, that are visible today, and the ones that they're talking about cutting back and placing on top of probably tailings too, when they get to the mitigation work here, and when they start that in the next 2 years. So a little bit more detail of this is the lower road. This area is the one that got washed out in 06 and really isn't there. The flood of 1948 was a disaster where it was taken out also, but the company filled it back in, but the 06 got washed out again. And here we are, the Rogers home. And look at the size of that.
Can't go out, you go up.
But this is where, instead of going on this road, which is now blocked off, and you start over in here, and you go through a trail, and you come along this way, you see some vestiges of rock walls and so forth in here, and that's where these houses were standing at the time. This area got obliterated because this is where the village originally had its drain field for the septic system. This is the middle row, and you can see that these are fairly well-built homes. There's the top road, and there were houses on both sides. This is a long walk to get up in here, particularly in the wintertime. And here's another fairly substantial house itself with an upper story, main story, and a basement.
This is a pretty pretty modern picture. Look at all the TV antennas.
I was going to support that. Look at that right there.
Yeah.
And one of the engineers who was down here, he was the supervisor of the electrical and mechanical shops. And he was a fairly astute electrical guy, and he did some testing up here. He'd actually originally come from the Kellogg mining area, so he was kind of familiar with TV coming out of Spokane. And it turns out this valley faces almost directly toward Spokane. So he ran around with a TV antenna on his car and figured out where the signals were, and we found out we could get TV up there. But it looked almost like a usual winter snowstorm. Sometimes worse. And there's always a lot of pictures in the winter. This was in 1956, which was one of the, let's see, it was 50 feet of snowfall that year.
Mm-hmm.
And people were building tunnels.
That was in Life magazine.
Yeah. And I had a tough time trying. I wanted to get people to give me pictures in the summertime, but I never really got clear pictures. Always in the winter. Nobody ever took pictures in the summer, except the professional photographers. So everybody's always taking pictures in the wintertime. See, look at this. You know, the snow is up to the eaves or beyond. So this is up from the Kahn's house, and this is what I was talking about. This is Mrs. Kahn. Remember that house that was way up in the corner? And she had to walk all the way from down below up to get to that house, and all this snow that all had to be shoveled up. That was a long, long hike. And that same year, what it looked like down here. But when the sun came out, everything was great. Everybody was out on the road. One of the things I couldn't understand here is why there were cars on this particular road. One thing I'd point out, there were cars up here. They brought up and put the company on the top of the barges. But we weren't really allowed to have cars on the roads in the wintertime. And if you did not have a garage to store the car in, you could not have a car up here. So a lot of people parked their cars for the winter down in Chelan underneath, underneath the trees. But if you wanted to ship your car out, you could do that, and the company would take them out, and you could store them in one of the warehouses down in Chelan itself. One of the things we had to be very careful of was the snow load on the roofs. And this is Mr. Holzhauser, our longtime postmaster, shoveling off the snow. But this had to be done very, very regularly, otherwise you'd have a cave-in. The other thing was that eventually we had a small grocery store up here, which was located in the bottom of number 6 lodge over here. But families could order groceries from the grocery stores down in Chelan. And they put a whole package together, put the family's name on a box, deliver it to the dock, and the company would put them into a container of some sort, bringing them up on a barge. We got up to the dock in Lucerne, and they'd load these individual boxes onto a freight truck with the family's names, and the company would deliver these boxes of groceries to each and every family who had ordered them. And that was done for free, except of obviously paying for the groceries to the grocery store. Now, this is Mr. Rogers, who built that 10-story house. Oh. And he was very famous for his pickups, he always had a pickup. Fortunately, and this was a rock wall that he had built, all of which has been obliterated, and you only see a couple of feet or less than that. There's a story I need to tell about Mr. Rogers. He had this wonderful three-story house for all his children, and he needed more space. So he decided he needed to excavate the basement. The only problem was there was this great big huge rock in there that he could not move. Well, he worked underground, and he knew all about blasting, he thought. So I guess he must have dug a hole, because I don't know that he had a drill, or if he did, he did it manually, with a manual drill and a mallet. And he decided, well, this is a big block of stone. I don't think one stick is going to do it. Maybe I ought to use two sticks, anyway. So anyway, he let the whole thing off and ran. I think he broke just about every window in the house. Plus a few next door. His wife was really ticked off, as you can possibly imagine. And of course, this was a big wild explosion, and the manager was very unhappy. Mr. Curzon almost fired him. And the only reason he didn't get fired is this man was a very, very hard worker and a very, very dependable man. He was a great guy. Well, he survived that. He survived the story. But
did he get the rock out? Is what I want to know.
I think he did get the rock out, but that was kind of secondary. Well, this is another one of the houses that was a close-up. If you go up to the middle road, go west, you go down the hill, if anybody's been down there, you get down the bottom of the hill, and before you go up the other side, there's an intersection there. The left-hand road goes down to the main road. The right-hand portion goes up in this cul-de-sac, and it's up against the base of the hill. And this was the Bowie house. And this is a very, very unique house with these gables. And you can see it's a substantial construction of it, the side shingles and so forth.
Did he build it?
He built it. He built it with his son.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Mrs. Bowie was my first grade teacher. And she taught up here, I think it was 3 years, if I remember correctly. And next to them was the Evinger house. I don't get a very good view of it, but they built this particular house that's next door just to the east. This is on the lower corner of where you come up the hill to the middle road. And, you know, this is really great with this veranda on the top. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, you don't find, each one of these houses is individually built. They're all different. And we lived in this house for 3 years. And Mary Ellen and her folks, Hal and Florence Field, lived on the house on just the other side of this one.
Hey, Bill, we lived in that house for about a year and a half.
Well, that's right. I think I have a picture of your father and Al probably discussing something or other in there.
I didn't know you lived in that house.
Yeah, 42 to 45. There's a story on this one. This is the one of the lower houses next to the Rogers house. This is Helen Small. And we didn't have dryers up here. Few people had washers, but there were no dryers. Took way too much electricity. Of course, you had this picture laundry out in the wintertime. And with the snow depth, you had to get your clotheslines up high. Otherwise, you'd be dragging in the snow. So this was her task, to step out on this ledge in the wintertime, and you can just barely see the clothesline. This went up to a house and the row up above. So what they had to do then was coordinate when they were going to do the laundry and the usage of the laundry line. And it was one of those pole things with a pulley on both ends. And they had a vegetable garden. A lot of people did, just like the people, you know, like we have up here now. radishes, carrots. Not a very good soil to grow in, however. And there were some elaborate barbecues. This was back of the Sims house. Here again, this was on the very bottom row, so this didn't survive. But he had very elaborate rock work, as a number of other people did. And Mrs. Sims in her kitchen, very cozy kitchen, but it was really kind of typical of that time, and really kind of modern for that particular time. But electric stove and all that stuff. And the inside at the dining table in their living room. I don't know what's happened to Tootie. I haven't heard from her in a long time. Mm. They haven't been up here for quite a while. And this is the Ricks house, and Joe claims that they had the first TV, in Winston Town.
And they used to open the front door, and all the neighbors would come around and sit out there and watch TV.
Yeah.
A real social event.
Well, yeah, it was. Well, for heat, there were two methods, using fuel oil, which was brought up by the company, and people had tanks below ground, and they had to pay for their fuel, of course. The company would bring it in, and the cost of the fuel would be deducted from their paycheck. And then other people had wood furnaces, and the Forest Service would designate certain trees down primarily in the 9 mile area that could be cut and logged and bucked up, and there it was for the wintertime. Whoops, wrong thing here. In the village center, a recreation hall at that time. This was our car. I don't know why my father brought it up here. It was a Rocket, Oldsmobile Rocket 98. I don't know why he brought such a wonderful car up here.
You'd love to have that today, though.
Boy. And you see, well, look at that, the contrast and the other cars.
Bill?
Yes?
Back here. Whose car was that parked in front of the library?
I don't remember. I don't have the biggest idea at this point. And that's the fountain lunch, as it looked back then. There was no area. Back in here was actually a wall, which was taken out by the folks up here, which was for storage. But we had a full grill. You could go down here, and oftentimes a lot of families would go down here for a treat on Sunday nights and get a full dinner, fried steak or hamburger, hash browns, the way it was good. It was. We had a barber in their rec home. Village Center, just exactly where it is right now.
Same barber.
And this was as far as we kids could go. Get a haircut, and the rest of it was off limits down in the pool hall and card table. Kids weren't allowed down there. Not ever. That doesn't mean to say we didn't do it.
There you go.
So that's how the gymnasium looked at first. But it was a very multi-purpose facility, just like it is now. We did have men's basketball very early. The teams from Chelan and Peshawson came up here to play, and the teams went out. In fact, it was kind of an amateur men's team, and they did pretty well in some of the tournaments. And you might wonder how we had a full court basketball. But on the stage, there are four fittings that are still there today. And in the center, there is a cap that plunges down on a spring, which has screws in it, or threads, I mean. And this was a folding backboard. And it had fittings that go down into those hold points. And this would all fold up and had casters, and then we just roll it in on the back of the stage off to the side out of the way.
underneath the stage there is where they kept all the chairs on, remember?
Right.
On those big rollers.
Right.
Well, we still do.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right.
And in the wintertime, we still put up a, not a metal one, we have a wooden, you know, wooden frame, they put a backboard up and.
Oh, you do?
Play full court basketball.
Yeah, good, good.
Boy.
Always New Year's Eve dance, they bring in a band from the outside.
Oh, and it was, oh, the stories you used to hear about New Year's Eve dance.
And sometimes the adults had costume balls, and I think these are my folks right here.
This looks like Klinger down here in the front.
Oh, right here?
Yeah.
Tell by the dark glasses.
Right.
Nose.
Must have been.
Right period of time.
We had movies, and of course there was the windows up above. There were full feature-length movies three times a week, cartoons, news, and the whole works. And one of the things that we find appalling, we've talked about this before, was we never, never, ever stepped into that room when it was bare with street shoes.
Oh, I remember.
Remember the manager would come up and you'd break your kneecaps if you
that was
Duke with regular shoes on it. But there were tarps, two tarps as I remember, that were rolled up and put on carts and rolled underneath the stage.
Duke Robbins.
Duke Robbins, yes.
It was also Union Hall. And we did have a very, very strong union up here. And they had fairly good relationships, actually, with the company. It was a closed shop. Every worker up here had to belong to the union. That included us teenage workers had to belong to the union. That included the girls and the women. There were women who worked in the fountain lunch who earned union wages. In fact, Linda Powell tells a story of her mother who worked in the fountain lunch. And after they left, her father died of a heart attack up here, and the company allowed them to stay in their home until they completed the school year. And then they went back down to Chelan, and then she tried to apply for state workman's compensation. And she showed them what her wages were up here, and of course they were astounding by the standards of that time because they were union wages. Comparable to what the other people were earning up here. And she finally had to get a lawyer to get the proper compensation from the state. I believe, I should know this, but this is my father right here. Now, he was a degreed engineer. And what was very common when the engineers came up here, they would oftentimes go underground and work at hourly wages to get the experience. My father worked underground for 4 years and 1 year as a surveyor. Hmm. He had a classmate who came up here with him, Ben Clark, and some of you remember him. He did the same thing. And he wrote a story in his biography. He says he was going to go to initiation, but that was it. So he decided he was going to skip the union meetings. And George Lipsey, who was the manager at the time, pulled him aside and said, you know, we need to have proper relations with the union. And sometimes you just have to bite the bullet. Well, Mr. Clark says he got the message, went to union meetings. But it also raises a story that was kind of difficult for me because later on my father was in management, and not only that, he was on the contract negotiation team for the company, which kind of put him in a difficult position because by agreement with the union, even us teenagers had to belong to the union. So it came time for me to join the union, and my father pulled me aside and says, you're not to ask any questions. I'm going to tell you what you are going to do. You're going to go down to the union meeting. You're going to get initiated, get your stamp, get it in your book, and you're to come home. And you are never, ever to go to a union meeting again, and don't you ever talk about it. And this is the first time I've talked about it. And to this day, I really don't know if that applied to even any of my other friends. But it's kind of an interesting situation. It's not something that you could really do anyplace else, but it does give you an example of how a company town can and will operate if they have to in order to make it operate successfully. And it was controlled. Well, that's what the bowling alley originally looked like. And point out that we did not have any cheating motors to run the pin setting. It was all manual with a bar. But many of the single men from the dormitory would earn extra money by setting the pins.
Kids do. I set pins. Doug Robertson, Don Davidson, yeah. Ernie Robertson, or Davidson.
And the pool hall. In the back was the card room. And this is one of Larry's photographs here, playing poker. If you look very closely, you might count how many aces he has.
Is that George Folk?
I really don't know. This is very early.
Yeah.
Agape was our hospital. And one of the requirements was that the doctor's wife had to be a nurse in the early days. And the reason was that for their living quarters, they used an apartment on the east end of the hospital. And there wasn't any way they could really house our two separate people. They had several beds and bedrooms, examination room, and so forth. For emergencies, people had to go out. Later time frames, they did deliver babies. Even in the early times, there were some babies delivered also. It was not the normal course. My mother went out twice for my brother and myself, which was the natural occurrence. I think Linda Jensen has been trying to collect these statistics, and I think we found that maybe, I think the number is about 12 children were actually born up here.
Boy, that would be...
Which surprised me that there were that many.
It'd be terrific to be able to say you were 4 and older.
Yeah, well, you'd have to, the mother would have to be very, very healthy before the doctor accepted this. If you had any emergency where you required emergency blood infusion, that would be a real problem.
Back to the recreation for a minute. Chuck Lutz's history book, he talks about that there was some word that a young Elizabeth Taylor came into the village entertaining. Is there any veracity to that statement?
Yes, Elizabeth Taylor was up here. The MGM filmed parts of Challenge. Courage of Lassie, thank you. And part of that was filmed up here in the Railroad Creek. Part of
it
was filmed
up in Mohegan.
And she stayed, and her entourage, they wouldn't stay up here. She was too good for that, but she stayed up at Moore's Point, which is the next one up the lake.
Yeah, I think she was 13 years old.
Yeah, she's, I believe that's right.
Well, okay.
And you couldn't get her on a horse, and she'd ridden in National Velvet. And Daisy Weaver said she was a spoiled brat.
Yeah, right. Well, for those of you who remember Dr. Wong, who eventually was one of the better doctors, long, long time, well-liked doctor in Cheyenne.
He was one of the first doctors.
He's one of the first doctors up here examining Mr. Penberthy. We also had a traveling dentist, and for those who remember Dr. Dewar.
Dr. Dewar.
Yeah. I can't remember how often he came up, because his primary practice was done in Chelan. I don't know if it was once a month or every 2 months.
No, like two, three times a year, maybe.
Yeah.
Oh, and boy, was he finesse incarnate, I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't like Dr. Dewar.
And of course, the dining hall at that particular time frame.
Wow.
And one of the dormitory rooms, which looked the same. Of course, a lot of them have been redone. All these walls and the ceilings were all Celotex. Everything was Celotex here.
Those are not the pictures those guys had.
Yeah. getting to some of the activities, we did have softball up here. We had various softball teams. The Diamond Drillers, the Miners, Mill, always the Engineers, Surface, Store, depending upon how many people are willing to play softball.
Why doesn't anybody ever talk about the tin money?
The tin?
Oh, well,
go ahead, they'll talk.
We do, sometimes. But sometimes teams would come in, but they had much better pitchers. Generally, the score was infinity zero. We really didn't have the pitchers up here. But the teams up here, so would we play every Friday night? I think it was just once a night, I mean once a week.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And there are bowling leagues, men's and women's, two or three times a week. Hmm. And they would go out to tournaments in Chelan. One of the things I also point out is that on Saturday mornings, the alleys were reserved for the kids. And we started out learning bowling by using duck pins. And then as we got older, we then graduated up to the full-size bowling balls. But a number of us learned bowling right here in these same lanes. There were picnics up here, 4th of July and Labor Day. Here's our friend Linda Jensen right here.
Yep,
Linda Powell Jensen.
Linda Powell.
The company paid for everything for the 4th of July picnic. And the union, of course, picked up the Labor Day picnics. And they had full everything, and we had races, pie eating contest, and there's Linda again. And three-legged races, sack races, men had dash races, sprint races, tug-of-war, you name it, they did it. Nail pounding, sawing logs.
Anybody remember the year that the 4th of July softball game got called up because of snow?
Yeah, things happen. Getting into school activities, we always had a Christmas program. All the kids in the school participated. The entire community attended. And the community club provided Christmas presents for every kid in town who could walk up and visit Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. And this is Johnny Akers, who was helping out to Santa Claus. Let's see, Linda told me who this person was, and I can't remember who it is.
Winnie Meredith?
Yeah, right, thank you. And everybody showed up, dressed to the hilt. That was one thing everybody did back then, yes. Suit and tie.
Yeah.
We don't do that anymore.
Yeah, I am.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Where are you, Uncle Jay?
In with the overalls on.
With the...
Overalls?
The overalls?
Oh, okay.
Oh, right there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What year? Tower drum behind me.
Yeah.
What year was this?
And there was Bernie Trainer.
Where?
Right across from me. Yeah, right there.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is Don Carey right here in the front with the glasses.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Right, yeah.
This is probably one of the Crumb Boys, isn't it?
Yeah, Howard.
Howard?
He got killed up on the Bonanza.
Yeah, I remember then when that happened. One of the difficulties up here, of course, is that when families chose to stay after we graduated from the eighth grade, now what do you do? We had no high school up here. And what happened was various varieties depending upon the particular family. Some folks went to private schools. There were private schools for boys and girls.
two separate ones in Seattle, Spokane, and Tacoma. Some folks went out to relatives in Wenatchee and Chelan. And some folks actually sold their houses in Winston. The father would live in the dormitory, and the family would either buy or rent a home down in Chelan, and the children would go to high school in Chelan itself. And father would go down the road on the weekends, get an airplane, and fly a float plane down, and come back on Chelan Airways. School also had spring programs every year, sometimes singing programs, and this is something with Tom Tom that I was in, Dale with Joel Riggs and whatever. We did operettas, we did musicals, we did recitals. Everybody and every student participated. This is one of the most elaborate Frog Prince operetta. Very elaborate sets. Find them all.
Stand up to
you. Here again, you see all the way down to first graders participating. We had campfire. This is Mrs. Florence Field, who was a campfire leader very early on with some of the Rogers girls, Carol Holterhoff, and so on. My mother got tired of dealing with just two boys, so she led the campfire one year, and they would go out to district functions and so forth down in the Chelan and Wenatchee. We had a Boy Scout troop in the early days, I think. Bernie Trainer was involved at that time, but they actually ended up climbing Glacier Peak in the background. We, on the other hand, went up here to 10 Mile and practiced first aid in the snowbank. And I can remember one year we went up there, and you know, we didn't have very good tents back then. We didn't have any insulation to lay on the snow. We didn't know how to build igloos, and I remember I remember going up there, hiking up there, and it was good and clear. We built a bed of snow of boughs, laid them out, laid our sleeping bag out, and I was sitting there at night in the snowbank looking up at the stars. I wonder, what am I doing here?
Did you guys ever see bears back then?
There were very few bears around here. There were on occasion, my brother claimed that he was chased by a bear up here in behind Lodge 3. But sometimes there would be when the ladies were cooking up jam and other preserves, because they would smell that strong sugars. And the times there, bears might come down. But generally speaking, we really weren't bothered. Not like Stehekin, which is can be pretty critical up there. Oops. And we went out to Camp Bree many times as one of our trips, and we went out to Chelan, and we joined other troops. In fact, I met some of my best friends even today that I met scouting. A lot of times, instead of coming back right away, we'd have to come back on Monday on the boat, and we'd stay with families in Chelan overnight on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And so it was there was a lot of relationship between here and the folks in Chelan. I show this just an example. One of the things that really, really made this a community is that it depended a lot upon the people in any community who come in and really help out, work with the children, and they give us a lot of activities to do. And we had one we were very lucky, Jim and Marion Sullivan, who came up. Mm-hmm. And Jim was a very, very strong mountain climber. And they really loved hiking. And what they really liked, and Jim ended up being the scoutmaster for the last few years that the mine was open. And they would take us out on trips, weekend trips. We'd hike up to Lyman Lake, we'd hike up to Holden Lake. I remember one time we hiked down the valley
on the Railroad Creek Trail, which is on the south side of the valley, down to where we could then bushwhack our way up over into Mirror Lake on the other side of the Indian side, things like that. And up into Holden Lake, and we climbed up to the top of Martin Ridge, and here we are signing the log up there looking across at Bonanza. And they taught us a little bit of mountain climbing, and this was the doctor's son here. This is myself in the middle and my eighth grade classmate right here. And we climbed up to the top of Copper Peak, and we're looking right down. And that's just right straight up there. That's all you have to go. And the other thing the Sullivans were very responsible in doing, and this was Marion, was convincing our community club, and everybody pitched into the community club financially to keep it going. There were dues, and part of those dues were used to pay for the Christmas presents, and he convinced them to buy a rope tow. And for a lot of people, this was their first introduction to any kind of ski tow, and it was just basically very simple single-cylinder engine mounted on a four-man toboggan. And then you'd anchor the rope up at the other end. And in the 20 years that we were up here, that was the first time my dad ever got on a rope tow after he had left Seattle. And there was a lot of people were introduced to skiing. And as it says now, of course, we had a daily bus service from here down to Lucerne. And this was one of the very early buses before the platform got extended out this way. And also in the wintertime. And then, of course, they had to keep the road open. We had a snow blower, and they'd have to go down the road, clear out the road. And some, a lot of times they'd come back crippled because we had very horrendous avalanches down the road, bring down rocks and trees, and sometimes they get lodged in the flutes that carry the snow into the center of the blower. We had cats that would go around all the various buildings up through Winston, clear out all the roads. Of course, that was required for fire protection purposes, and there was also a road grader as well. And there was one year I can remember we were shut down for a whole week, and they had just a tremendous series of avalanches down there, and they had to bring in supplies, walk them across the avalanches, and there were rocks and trees and everything else that they had to clear out. For emergency power services, occasionally the electrical wires would go down too, and the men had to go down the road on snowshoes and fix the electrical wires. So we had a very, very large diesel engines up at the top of the 1500 level that were capable of generating enough electricity to keep everything going down the mine, which was very, very important because it was a wet mine and it did have to keep the pumps going. And also for emergency purposes, and there's enough power to keep the entire town electrified. Back then, of course, with the boat transportation, and this was the old Speedway, which was built in 1937. Speedway. And one time it got burned at the dock down in Chelan, had to be rebuilt. And then there was the original Lady of the Lake as well. But at the time that this mine was operating, they were all wood-pulled boats. This one was kind of a scream in a way that there was no stairway to get from the lower deck to the upper deck. So you had to come out this nose door and run the steps to get inside the cabin up above. But there was seating on both top and bottom. These were some of the early boats in a photo that was taken back in 1937, and that's the earlier version of the same Speedway, same hull, but a little bit different superstructure on top because of that particular fire in the later photo. Then there was the transportation, getting everything in and out of here. This is the original dock with the locomotive crane. And there was a shipway right here where they could bring the tug out of the water and work on it, repair it, bring the scows up part way and work on those as well. I show some of these pictures just to give you an idea of how we got things in and out of here. And of course, these were the ore buckets. Each of these buckets held 5 tons of concentrate. Each bucket weighed 1 ton. These trucks carried 3 for a payload of 18 tons. So it was probably about 22 tons of weight with these trucks going up and down the road every weekday. They did not operate on the weekends. For the cars, they would roll the cars onto these pallets on the dock. And then there was a four cable assembly that hooked onto this hook. And then the cables would hook to the corners and just lift them up onto the top of the ore buckets. And the company did this for free for those people who wanted to move their cars up and down the lake. And I think I have another picture. I think this is one of the refrigeration units right here that was used to bring the groceries up. Yeah, here it is right here. There was a little compressor on top operated by a little gas engine. And this is how we brought our perishables up.
In all the years of operation, Bill, did they ever lose a barge?
No. There were 3 throughout the entire period.
Mm.
In fact, Mary Ellen's father, how many did he buy? All 3? Or just
2,
one?
I think. But I'm not sure.
Hmm.
But this looks like it was a four-hole Buick. And here's a close-up of the tub. Well, 1957, here we are. I think there were 121 children in school at the final year. And it was kind of amazing. It seemed like the last couple of years was the highest population of children up here, which was kind of a testament to people really sticking it out. So everything finally went silent. The mill stood there. There was no noise, no dynamiting. The house is standing empty, and remember we saw this one earlier with the gables and the buoy house. They took the windows out. 2 people dismantled their homes and the company agreed to take them down the lake for free. And then the people provided their own transportation to haul the parts of their houses out. I think one family hauled their house all the way up to a mining area north of Spokane.
Was there ever any mining accidents?
Yes, there were mining accidents. Linda has been tabulating that, and I think what we came up with is on average there's about 1 fatality a year, most of which were accidents of men that were not observing the proper safety rules. But it was considered a very, very safe place to operate. They had safety signs all over the place. There was safety engineer assigned to the underground. There was a safety engineer assigned to the mill as well. So they were watching things very, very carefully.
Did they have really long hours?
They were 8-hour shifts, and they worked 3 shifts a day. And they normally shut down most of their operation on Friday night. Sometimes when they had to catch up, or they had one union strike where they had to catch up on. But normally they shut down on Friday nights, and then they'd start up again on Sunday. But during the weekday, they would be running all night, or all 24 hours a day, 3 shifts, 8 hours a week. And that raises a good point, too, because those people had to be fed. And the dining hall was open 24 hours a day. They had, at least in the very beginning, their cooks were cooking hot meals 24 hours a day until it got to be too costly, and then they went more to cold cuts and lunches and that kind of thing.
but it was open 24 hours a day for meals.
What was the peak number of miners in approximately what year would that have been?
That
the largest number of miners at one time?
You know, I do not know the actual miner count. I've never tried to do that. I really would not be able to give you a good estimate that I could depend on.
I think the crew, including
I would,
the different department, was about 300.
Okay. And I would assume that probably was around the 1950 time period, because I think that was probably about the peak production, when there was about over 700 people living in. That's one of the other, and this is after, I think, about two winters of operation. And even look at the veranda up here, it's still in pretty good shape. The houses eventually, of course, had to be taken down by agreement with the Forest Service, bulldozed over and burned. Some of the houses didn't make it too well. These are some of the newest houses, even with the metal roofs, but they were not built that substantially.
Bill, that was Hollingsworth's house, and we lived there. We moved in after Dean, and then moved out. All you had was the rafters and aluminum. That was it for the roof.
Yeah.
And the house was not, the main floor was finished, but as you can tell, the attic part wasn't.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. Plus, the snow would come off the roof and back up.
Yeah.
So Dad always had to shovel it.
So, there we are, abandoned Boy Scout cabin, and that's sand. Anybody have any questions that we can answer?
Was there a church in the village, or had it religious life?
Okay, how we worked church services kind of varied during the time frame up here. There was not a church. We chose not to have churches up here. What we did is we did have non-denominational services, just like you do right now. And during part of the time frame, we had a minister who would come in once a month and conduct those services. We had a Sunday school conducted by the mothers every Sunday. Late in the game, there was a fellow who came up that we eventually called the preacher, but he was a lay person. And he offered to conduct sermons every Sunday morning, which he did, and that was in the latter years of the mine.
Then you mentioned, you know, that you keep the streets plowed for fire prevention. Did you have volunteer firefighters or had it?
I don't know exactly how that worked, but there were volunteers, and I don't know what kind of call-up system they have. I don't remember. We did have a fire chief. In fact, that was his house that I showed you, his daughter was in front of him. And I would assume they had a kind of a plan, given everything else that they did. This particular gentleman was also the constable, and he was elected and paid by the county. But you've seen the fire houses all around.
Yeah.
They did have a fire truck up here. I don't know what they would have done by getting it into the upper reaches of Winston, because it's a very, very steep hill, and even a truck with chains on would not be able to get up there. So I suspect, but I don't know, they may have been dependent upon the cats to haul them up. The lady that was sitting in the corner back over here, Mary Ellen Field, her parents' house burned down. It was in the middle row, the fourth house in, and it burned so badly it had to be replaced. But it was in the middle of the winter. But they were able to get the fire truck up there, pulled the hoses out. As far as I know, there was no problem with the water, but the house just went too fast.
Why did it burn?
You know, I don't remember. We'd have to ask her, but she stepped up, and I really don't remember. There was another house very, very early that burned down, and the problem with it is that they had used some rocks that had not been properly cured, if you will. At least that's what we speculate. The rock exploded, and that
coming out of the fireplace, apparently in that particular house, and that house did burn down. But as far as other fires, like Mr. Penberthy has photographs of the hotel burning, and they had a fire in the upper rafters, which I don't know what caused it, because there's no documentation that I could find on, but it's probably an electrical fire. And he has photographs, a whole sequence of photographs of everybody standing around, the fire trucks there, and they got the hoses out, and there's obviously people who are manning the hoses and going up inside and inspecting the interior of the upper reaches of the hotel.
So they were able to put it out in time, right?
They did. It looked from his photographs that the damage was very, very minimal. And the only other fire I remember was up in Honeymoon Heights. I don't know, it was probably a Cook's fire, but the original bunkhouse up in Honeymoon Heights caught on fire, and it burned down. And that was before the facilities down here had gotten built. And so they had to put the people who were in that bunkhouse into the construction buildings that were sitting down at the bottom, and the families took in a lot of the others to cover them until they were only weeks away from getting the facility built down here.
Those you didn't have any pictures of Honeymoon Heights in there, or did you?
I did, yeah.
Do you remember Gracie Hawks and her husband who used to live in Honeymoon Heights?
I don't remember. The Holtzes lived in Winston.
Oh, didn't she start out in Honeymoon Heights?
I don't remember.
I think so, because she told us we were very good. She was a very good friend of ours. And she talked about Honeymoon Heights very, that was the best time of her life, probably before she had all the babies.
Yeah. We don't have complete listings of all the people who lived in Honeymoon Heights, and I just don't remember that.
But she lived here then after.
I know they lived
in Winston after
the same Holt, Grace Holtz.
Grace Holtz.
Yeah, and her Pat.
Pat, yes, and Carol wasn't there, and Dick, right? We still know Dick.
Yeah, and when I knew them, they were living up in Winston.
Okay, well, she might have come here before.
Could be, but before I knew what was going on.
But you still remember her, that's nice.
Yeah, I do.
She died a few years back, and she was a good friend. I still miss her. She was a wonderful lady. Okay, well, that was very, very interesting. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you very much.
You called it really well, too.
It got a little long, but I apologize.
I love that. That was great.
When did the mill go from its, you know, state to sort of skeleton that it has now? Was that taken apart by the mining company, or?
Yeah, it was taken apart by another company. It was taken down as much as it could.
Yeah.
In 1959, I kind of remember that date because I actually drove my brother up here in our boat and dropped him off down to Lucerne. He was employed by the company that took it down. And they took down, and it was actually a steel salvage company, and they were trying to salvage all the metal, and I don't know what they did exactly with the equipment, but I don't know why they left some of that structure that they did, but I have a sneaking feeling that perhaps they started running out of money. I don't know what the circumstances were. There were a lot of people said that, well, everything burned up there, and they may have had a fire, and they said that, well, there's no record, but I can attest. Having brought my brother up here, there was a salvage company that didn't try to dismantle it.
And perhaps somebody told me that it would time to be too expensive to dismantle the steel girders that are the skeletons in the mill.
What, you mean the rest of them?
Yeah.
In talking with Forest Service one day, they assessed it as being too dangerous. And they didn't want to really put anybody underneath.
That's probably what I'm thinking of, because wasn't Norm Day here 2 years ago? And
yes.
Right. So I sat and talked with him in the dining hall after that, and I think that's why he said it was considered to be too dangerous, and that's why.
He seemed to kind of emphasize that in the public hearings meetings that I went to down in Chelan and Wyatt and Natchez. concerning the mitigation plans.
They weren't sure yet. There was more planning to be done. There's a lot of detailed planning to be done, so I got the impression they really weren't quite sure yet whether they were going to be able to remove those or not. So they look very, very dangerous and unsafe.
So did they just decide to close the mine because it just wasn't profitable?
The reason they closed the mine is because the price of copper plummeted. It became completely unproductive.
And weren't there other supplies of copper available from other countries overseas?
That's right. That's why the prices dropped.
Right. And so part of the reason that Holden Mine was so successful is because it was instrumental in the war effort.
Yeah.
It supplied copper domestically.
Yeah. Well, it did, but it was very profitable even after World War II, for that matter. You figure that, you know, the peak production, it was in around the 1950 time frame, even after World War II.
Right.
But they really reached the end of it. There's no mineable ore really left, and this is a very low-grade ore. This was, even though it was the largest low-grade ore mine in the Pacific Northwest. But you're talking about a concentration that was about 1.5%, and it wasn't going to really pay off. The transportation out of here was very expensive. You look at the handling of the trucks down to the lake, onto the barge, back onto trucks, down to Cheyenne Falls, and then dumped into the Great Northern Railroad cars, and then to Tacoma. And that's a very, very expensive process.
Yeah.
Plus the fact, after 20 years of operation, you know, they never replaced any of the equipment underground. The motors or locomotives that were used to haul the ore out, the ore cars, none of that got replaced as far as I know. You look at the mill equipment that's been operating pretty much around the clock for 20 years, and I don't think any of the crushers ever got replaced. They took
so they had been able to continue, if it had been worthwhile to continue, they would have had to modernize that piece. Because
absolutely.
Surely mining technology can travel long ways in those 20 years.
Yeah. And, you know, it had been very, very expensive to take that equipment out and then start replacing it. In order to replace, say, the whole bank of four ball mills, they would have to take them out and replace with new ones. And, you know, how do you do that without shutting down the mine? And that would have to be pretty expensive.
Well,
they did move
the
jaw crusher underground, but here again, you know, I don't know how, if it was worn out too, but it was sitting down in the bottom of the mine, below the 1500 mark, so that they would have smaller pieces of rock to bring up the ore hoist. So what kind of shape was that in?
Did the mine give the miners notification several months in advance or years?
They did. They gave notification in April of 57, and the last day of operation was 1st of July.
So about 3 months?
Yes. However, I think if anybody was really paying attention to what was going on underground, certainly the management knew. I have to admit that they knew something. If you were paying attention to the production, what was going on, everything was going on, it should have been pretty obvious that they were reaching the end of the line. It was advertised not exactly right at the very beginning, but certainly after they started offering that this was basically a 20-year mine. That's about as much ore that was in the combination of all the ore bodies that they had been able to find. They really didn't find anything.